Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Well, welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and again, we're going to be talking about the Kingdom of God, and we're going to do it by looking at the book of Leviticus, and we'll probably not even get into chapter 1. We just finished Genesis, pretty much all of Genesis. There's a few chapters at the very beginning that we can go back to. We've talked about them, but we've interlaced them into other Bible studies. There's a huge, broad list of Bible studies over every single chapter of the Bible that are already put up on Preparing You. And of course, we don't have all of them done in the detail that we want, but all of the Bible is up there at preparingyou.com. And it's a great source, in my personal opinion, if you really want to understand what Moses was doing, what Jesus was doing, because they were doing the same thing. Why Abraham went away from the activities of the nativity of his family, of his family's deeds. His father was an idolater. You say that to 90% of the people, and they don't really understand what an idolater is, what idolatry is. And they're very confused. I was listening to some people on X talking about this thing, debating. Supposedly it was kind of a free-for-all. Actually, there was a couple different groups, and it always descended into a free-for-all where people are talking over each other and arguing with each other. And I get it. It's a passionate subject. But the problem is that most of the people that come and start talking about these ideas that are in the ancient biblical texts, and we could use a lot of different texts in the world. I mean, Christians aren't the majority of people in the world. Just as, I mean, like, people talk about, you know, whites doing all kinds of things, you know, that's a big thing. Have been in the news for years and years now, you know, white guilt, and we've talked about some of the books like that that have come out, and it's all divisive. And it's funny because the most divisive ideas come from things like where they talk about inclusion and equity and fairness for everybody, social justice, and they're actually causing huge divisions between people. It's the same divisions if you are on the ground at the time of Nimrod and Babylon. It'd be the same divisions you would see. They put it into a simple little phrase where they talk about this division that took place in Babylon as confusing the language. And then everybody started speaking different languages and couldn't understand each other. Well, the reality, that's happening right now in the world today. People speak the same English language, but they use words that create confusion because they don't really define their terms. You know, like, what's God? I don't know hardly anybody who should even imagine that they have the same exact understanding of the word God in their mind as the person they're talking to. They will have a little bit different version of who God is. There was somebody that was just on a plane. It looked like maybe it was maybe New Zealand Airlines, or if there is such a thing, but I was trying to recognize the accents of the people on the plane, and somebody stood up and started yelling, you know, Allah Akbar and death to America. I couldn't quite make out everything he was saying, and of course he had an accent too, because he was probably from some Muslim country, And eventually the passengers, somebody just grabbed them and pulled them down, and they sat on them, so to speak, and took his cell phone away from him and said, "Why are you yelling?" And he was yelling things about a bomb and all this kind of stuff. It was just really a bad way to win friends and influence people on an airplane. It seemed like a very tight little airplane. I don't know where it was at or anything. And you never know if these things aren't staged. But it looked real, looked authentic. His idea of God was probably not the same as the idea of God that everybody else was thinking. Because words, we fall prey to language, and language is nothing but confusion. But if nothing, it is confusion. If nothing else, it is confusion. So I just said the same thing several different ways. Because we don't take the time to find out what words mean. And going into Leviticus, we're going to see all kinds of words. In one of the first articles, the first book I wrote was Covenants of the Gods. And it was based on law. And that's the path that God set me on because of maybe my background or whatever. God's got a plan. My image of God, in my mind, has no effect on whoever God is. But it's what I've got as an image of God, and I don't profess that it is perfect, but I like to walk around the subject. But it's a big subject, because, you know, the Greeks referred to God as the unmoved mover. I've referred to him as the divine designer. The Bible refers to him as Yahweh, or the existing one. And so there's lots of different ways. And, of course, that was the controversy when we did Genesis, is that, you know, who shall I say sent me? And say that I am the I am. You know, kind of, that was the, basically, I am the existing one. The divine designer. Or at least, whoever was speaking to him was speaking with and from the divine designer. And, you know, if there is a God, a universal divine designer, a creator of heavens and earth, and, you know, a singularity of pattern that is coming from some source that is outside of space and time, all very difficult things to comprehend. Scientists actually seem to be talking about that is what is actually going on when they study things like quantum. And of course, I just mentioned singularity. That's kind of a term that is now found in science to promote certain theories of why everything is the way that it is. And it's very complicated, and we can't quite pin it all down, but we should make a concerted effort to try to understand what somebody means when they use a particular word. It's just a good habit. If you're talking about ball games, or you're talking about existential threats, or you're talking about politics, you're talking about religion, you're talking about philosophy, you're talking about the nature of mankind, the nature of nature, you need to try to get into the actual meaning of words. Some people want to immediate, and one of the people conversing want to throw out anything to do with the Bible, because you have to depend on the Bible to prove what you think is true. No. I don't have to depend upon the Bible. It's just part of our vocabulary. And unfortunately, and anybody who's listened to us on a regular basis know that we're constantly taking a look at words as they were used at the time the Bible was written. If you want to study the Constitution, you're going to go get a Bouvier's Law Dictionary, because that's supposedly telling you what the words used in the Constitution meant at the time they used it. Well, like if they're going to talk about freedom of religion, you know, that we're not to establish any kind of public religion. Of course, the reality is, once we understand the word and the meaning of religion, they have established a public religion. And if you don't join that public religion, it's very difficult to practice your religion. So almost everybody has two religions, including the atheists. I don't know hardly a single atheist that doesn't have some sort of participation in what could only be called public religion as we understand the word religion at the time of Christ. Because religion was how you took care of the needy of your society. Pure religion was taking care of the needy of your society unspotted by the world. And Leviticus is going to be talking about how to take care of the needy of society. And it's going to use all kinds of words. You know, like cattle and flocks and sheep and goats and burnt sacrifices and male offerings and without blemish. But there's enough of the words there that we should start to get an idea of what Leviticus is actually talking about. What Moses, now see, I could mention Moses when he wrote Leviticus, but a lot of people say, oh, you think Moses wrote Leviticus? Well, I don't care if you believe if Moses wrote Leviticus or not. As, maybe Steve wrote Leviticus and attributed it to Moses. Personally, I believe because of the singularity that the book was inspired. I have no way of proving that Moses wrote Leviticus. Traditionally, that's what they say. I'm okay with that. What I want to know is, whoever wrote it, what did he mean? And if it's inspired, then it was written by the singularity, by this common divine designer, through the instruments of men's hands and language, etc. Some of the oldest archaeology in the world has all kinds of relief and carvings in stone. But not a single word. Because it didn't seem to have language at that particular time. And some people will tell you that those stone carvings and those buildings and structures that were carved out of solid rock in some cases were carved before the flood. Thousands of thousands of years ago. But other people say, no, no, Adam was born 1,000 years ago. Do you really believe, this is what one of the guys said, do you really believe that God was molding him out of clay and, breathing life into man, and that he took a rib from man and created woman in the same way? Do you really believe that? Well, that's what it says, isn't it? Well, is it? We know the Bible is full of metaphors. We know the Hebrew language is full of metaphors. We know the Bible says that it's an allegory. Does that mean there wasn't an Adam and Eve? No. Does it mean that God didn't mold Adam out of Adama? Because that's actually what it says in the Hebrew. Adama has a word there. Out of Adama. And we translate it into red clay. And it could be red clay. But as we'll see as we go through Leviticus, many, many words, and in many of our other studies, you have basic words, 3 letters long, maybe 4 letters in some cases. And they may mean numerous different things. A liver may mean to honor somebody or fatten somebody, or to kidneys may mean kidneys, or it may mean reins of control. It's translated both ways. Same word, translated both ways. And this is the case with hundreds and hundreds, even thousands of words. They have multiple ways they can be translated. So you have to look at the context. And of course, that's what we do, is look at the context of the Bible at the time it was written. If you want to know the Constitution, you have to read the letters of the guys who put the Constitution together to try to find out what did they really mean when they talked about the need for a well-regulated militia, or the right to bear arms, or freedom of the press. Did they mean everything you think they meant? Did everything Chuck Schumer thinks they meant? Or I'm just trying to think of people you might know in the news, because all these people have different opinions as to what the Constitution meant. I'm old enough, I've remembered Chuck Schumer when he was young, or Biden when he was young. And Biden was talking about we have to go after the drug cartels and actually attack them, make war on them, you know, to destroy them because they're destroying, and he was advocating this. And now when they're doing it, all the Democrats are upset. Now I'm not taking either side. I'm for righteousness. But in order to find out what that means, I have to do some personal soul searching, and I read lots of different opinions of other people. I listen to different opinions of people. I try to find out what they meant by certain words when they said them. And this is not new. I mean, we can go back to Alice in Wonderland. I have also written an article, Sophistry. I went back and was revisiting that this morning. I wrote it so long ago as part of the book, Thy Kingdom Come, which is free online at hisholychurch.org. You just look up the name, Thy Kingdom Comes. And you can download it, read it. And in one of the chapters, we talk about the altars. And, of course, Leviticus is going to talk about altars and sacrifices. And I go through the Hebrew words. And I have footnotes. And I wrote it a long time ago. And then it's kind of the article Sophistry at preparingyou.com. But now I've written hundreds of articles that cover many of the words that we find in the text. A ram, or the rump of a ram. They talk about that in the Bible. Are they really just talking about the rump of a ram? And when they talk about kidneys, that the Levites get the kidneys, are they talking about kidneys? Is that what that all the Levites just eat lots and lots of kidneys? Because that's their share. Or are they talking about the Levites have the reins of control? Well, control of what? They're just going to burn it up, right? They're going to burn it up. But are they? Is that really what it's saying? Well, we'll explore all those things as we go through Leviticus. And we have explored them. But one of the things, like I say, I quote Alice in Wonderland at the beginning of the chapter of Sophistry. And it says, when I use a word, Humpty Dumpty said, in a rather scornful tone, it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less. And the question is, said Alice, whether you can make words mean so many different things. The question is, said Humpty, which is to be master, that is all. So, I quote that because you're ruled by what you think. You're imprisoned by what you think is true. You believe that something is a certain way, and you actually won't go beyond that. You know, they perform surgeries in some places just using hypnosis. Anesthesiologists don't like that because they don't make money. But there's actually people who, you know, they've done this where people can stop bleeding just by the way they think. They restrict the veins in their own body to stop bleeding so that they don't die. You can do all kinds of things with your mind. You can fool yourself and you can fool others and you can create confusion. And this is what was happening. The people were being divided by the system of the government of Babylon, which was full of idolatry. But if we go all the way up to the time of Paul, Paul tells us idolatry is covetousness. It's not about statues. The statues are just representative of authority. Nimrod couldn't tell everybody what to do. He couldn't get around and collect taxes from everybody to support his government and support his army. So he gave power to the governors. And the governors gave power to their captains. And the captains gave power to their lieutenants. And the people signed on with this lieutenant or this captain or this governor. And they, in order to show whose authority you were under, whose protection you were under, you had a little statue. Eventually, it became, in the time of Rome, a little tessera, like a coin made out of clay with a symbol on it that said, you are a part of this group or a part of that group. Everybody was looking for identity with a group. In Rome, at the games, there wasn't hundreds of different teams. Oh, there might have been, but basically there were two groups. I don't know, NFL or whatever. And it was the reds and the greens. And you wore the red if you were supporting the red teams, and you wore the green if you were supporting the green teams. And there would be riots sometimes after the games because, according to half of them, the wrong team won. Or the wrong team, or a different team cheated. Or they bribed the referees, or whatever. And there'd be riots. But they got their identity from the group that they thought they belonged to. This divides people. When you start identifying with a group, you're dividing yourself from other people. You're no longer going to access the singularity, the divine designer, in the same way you would have before. People are complicated. You can hold more than one idea in your mind at one time. And you can hold an idea so tight that the idea is holding you. And the ideology in your head becomes your idol. And it controls your actions. So we want to not divide the people. We want to bring people together. In order to do that, sometimes you have to set down ideas you already have, which will include the meaning of words. And so we're going to say things in our study of Leviticus some people aren't going to like. Many people aren't going to see or understand. And so we've gone through, you know, like I say, I have the article on sophistry. And since I wrote it so long ago, and, you know, and then months later, maybe years later, I wrote other articles on the Essenes and the Nazarites and Moses and pure religion and the difference between the two. And we have this word world in the New Testament that shows up many times, but it's translated from four or five different, even it could actually be translated from six different words in the New Testament, depending on what Bible you're using. You know, King James, I think they only use about four different words, but there's certainly five. And they're different Greek words, but they're all translated into the single English word world. And we can take the word world, and it can mean all kinds of things. You know, Wayne's World. You know, the world of economics. The world of politics. Or the planet you live on. It could be all these things. So you have to try to hear what the person speaking or writing is trying to tell you. And we'll be back to do that in just a minute. Well, welcome back to Keys of the Kingdom. So, we're looking at this, we're going to be studying Leviticus chapter by chapter like we usually do and go through it. And I can't guarantee that we'll do it every single week. We may take side trips off into other articles that are already written, other studies that are already written, so that we keep up our foundation with trying to understand what Leviticus is really all about. And the book Leviticus, as the third book of the Torah and part of the Old Testament and the Pentateuch of Moses, may give us some insight into the structure of Israel, the role that the Levites in it, and the role of the people. We've talked recently about the fourth branch of government. And I put up an article now that touches on this, very brief, but just a kind of a commentary on the fourth branch of government, because there's different opinions as to what the fourth branch of government is. Some will tell you it's the vast bureaucracy, which is literally also we refer to metaphorically as the swamp. You know, it's all those bureaucrats that stay entrenched in government from different, you know, whether Democrats in power or Republicans in power. And there, and you can go back to the 60s with Supreme Court Justice Douglas, William O. Douglas, who talked about the what we had to realize was that the new George III is the vast bureaucracy that actually runs everything, controls everything. And because Congress, there was very few laws when Congress first met. They didn't have to meet all year long. They didn't have to have, you know, 100 aides. They just showed up and they did their thing. And they usually had other ways and means of support. And of course they had to show up. They had to ride a horse to get to Congress. And show up in Congress and vote on things, but they weren't, they were simply representatives of the people to the federal government. And at that early stage, the people were not even considered by law, by Supreme Court decisions, to be a part of we the people. We the people were those congressmen and senators and federal employees that composed the federal government. That was we the people. It wasn't every citizen in America. You weren't citizens of the United States at that time. In the first almost 100 years of the Constitution, there was no citizen of the United States. You were a citizen of your individual states. You were not considered a party to the Constitution. And people don't understand that. And they talk about the Constitution and what we should do and how we should form the government and what the Republicans should be voting on and what the Democrats should be voting on and what they should be deciding, how they should be making laws. And we argue these things as if we were sitting there watching a ball game and saying who the coach should put in next. And nobody at the game is listening to you. This is all rehearsed in your own mind. Like you could make sure that your team wins if they would only listen to you. What can we actually do to keep America free? To bring freedom and righteousness into the world. We have to do that on a personal basis. And you're a complex person, whoever you are, you're all complex. Because you have lots of different ideas and they're wandering around in your head and one pops up here and one pops up there. And we try to talk about complex issues, complex nations, you know, we glump everybody, if I can use that word, into a nationality. Oh, these people are Russians, and these people are Chinese, and these people are Jews, and these people are Catholics, but you can't do that. The more you try to lump people, the more you divide everybody. This is what happens when you go the way of Babylon. And of course, they talk in the Bible about a mystery Babylon coming. We could say, put the word there, secret Babylon. That people will go back into Babylon and they won't even know that they're going back into Babylon. The people who Leviticus is written for. And they'll tell you that the purpose of Leviticus, I have an outline there of the purpose, the instruction for the laity on bringing offerings. That's chapter 1, verses 1 through 6. You know, they talk about burnt offerings and grain offerings and peace offerings and purifications and reparations. Yeah, they were talking about reparations. But it was, or a reparation offering was also called a sin offering. You did something to somebody, as Omar would say. Somebody did something. Reparation offering was also called a sin offering. That you injured somebody, and maybe you can't pay back that individual. He's not there anymore. His family's not there anymore. And so you still have to give some kind of an offering to pay that back. But is there somebody actually up there with a tally sheet marking down numbers? Well, you need to pay a little bit more back. They're talking about the psychology of it. You know, like the father, his son is loading cement bags and somebody says, well, I can help him with that. No, let him do it himself. And the kid was just struggling with these 90-pound, I guess they were 90-pound, they could have been 50-pound bags of, gravel and Portland cement. Portland used to be 90 pounds. But people have gotten weaker, so they've been making bags smaller. So anyway, the fact is the kid struggled with it, why the father and this other guy talked, and eventually the boy got all the bags into the back of the pickup and had a big, huge grin on his face. That grin would not have been there had they helped him. It would not have been so broad if they had helped him. You have to do things. That's one of the amazing things. We're supposedly spiritual. A lot of people are going to argue with that. I see the spirit in a person. But we're also physical. And what we do physically may have an effect on who we are spiritually or mentally or emotionally. And you see this more clearly in a child growing up. But we're all supposed to be children of God, and God is so infinite, we don't have enough time in our life to even walk around the topic of God and examine it, whatever it is. Because we're so finite. We have such short lives. But we do it. And it's part of the process the Greeks called know thyself. And all these offerings they talk about in Leviticus is a part of that. We have to do it yourselves. You see, when they were in Egypt, they didn't have to store up grain for the day of famine. They had to pay in grain. If they produced grain, they had to share that grain with the government. 20% of their labor and what they produced belonged to the government of Pharaoh. That was the deal written out. And they were in bondage to do that. 80% of what they produced, they got to keep for themselves and for their family. But 20% went to the government. And that was called the bondage of Egypt. And it got worse and worse over the years. And we've talked about how that is. But now they had come out. Now they were creating a different form of government that was not like the government of Babylon, not like the government of Egypt, not like the bondage of Egypt, but it was different. And these instructions we find in Leviticus, at least in the first chapter, has to do with the people. They call them the laity in one outline. And I use that word because in the New Testament they talk about the Nicolaity. We shortened it up to Nicolaitans. And the Nicolaitans, God hates the deeds of the Nicolaitans. And Laitans are people, and Nico are conquered people. Well, Israel's not conquered anymore. They're free out in the wilderness. And Moses is going to tell them how to stay free and stay strong and maintain their freedom. And if we actually understood what he was talking about, the people of the world today, I don't care what country you're in, the people of the world today would be free. But they don't understand. And they're not hauling those cement bags to the back of the truck. They're not doing the work. They're doing different work. They're doing lots of work, but they're not doing the work of liberty. They're not doing the work according to the perfect law of liberty, which they talk about. And so, therefore, they have become captive again. And they're back in the bondage of Egypt, where 20% of their labor, or more, belongs to the government. That's a very simple statement, but if that was the bondage of Egypt, and now that's your particular status or state in the world today, whether you live in Australia or China or wherever, you belong to the government. You have a department called the Department of Human Resources. That's you. You're a human resource for the government. And they can borrow against your future and the future of your children. Your unborn children, your newly born children are in debt because you're back in the bondage of Egypt. But people don't want to see that. They may be turning the dial or going somewhere else. And they're not going to find out what Christ was doing, what Moses was doing to set the captive free. I hear all the arguments about, you know, this group of people are doing terrible things. This group of people are doing terrible things. This group of people are doing genocide. This group of people are doing genocide. And so we have to take sides, like the red and the green of Rome. Pick our team. No. Everybody is doing evil. Some doing it more than others. Yeah, yeah. Some are more outrageous. Some are cleverer, so you don't really see everything. Very difficult to see everything. But what can you see more of than anything else? Yourself. And there are things that have gotten into you, into your thinking, into your nature, that have created a ideology of bondage. And if you see those things and start thinking a different way, the bars will start to dissolve. The captive will be set free from his own bars and prison. And that's what Leviticus is going to try to do. He's going to try to teach you how to do that, to be separate from that bondage of the world. But you're still going to have to move the cement bags, or you're not going to get the smile. You got to do the work. But it isn't the work that saves you. Because that boy could have been loading those cement bags and resenting his father the whole time. When he finally got it done, I have a brother-in-law who used to have to load cement bags all the time. He's not quite as old as me, but he's up there now. But he used to have to do it for his dad, and he was a skinny, tall boy, oldest boy in the family. And his father ran a lumber yard, and he had to load those cement bags. And he did it on a pretty regular basis, I guess. And he remembers that. Yeah, I remember him telling me the story. Well, if he resented it, he didn't get the sense of accomplishment. If he allowed himself to do it with a good heart, then he not only, his muscles got stronger, his ability to work got greater. And that comes, your attitude is going to bring the blessing. Your intent is going to bring the blessing, not just the labor. So people who say you're not saved by works, absolutely true. You're saved by repentance. So that the joy of the blood of Christ can enter into you. But you have to bleed like him. If you're going to take on the nature of Christ, which is the nature of God, which sacrifices his power to control you so that you may have some choice in the matter. Very limited choice in comparison to God. But you have choice. So you can hear what we have to say or not. You can hear what the Torah really is about or not. But the Levites, at least in this first chapter, is evidently going to be about some of these sacrifices. And and I'm going to go through some of the articles that I wrote a decade or more ago and link them up better and better so they become, but we're going to actually add audios to some of those pages so that we can go through and explain it. We also, you can follow us on X. I'm Gregory at HHC on X. His Holy Church also has an X space. You can join that and follow that. You'll get notices when we're going to have spaces where you can come and ask questions. And where you can listen to other people ask questions and get copies of the recordings and copies of the shows that we do and copies of new, you know, links to new articles that we put up. Because if we actually understood what Moses was saying, we could find the liberty that a lot of people are looking for today. But they have to follow the way of Christ, which is the way of Moses, really. But you wouldn't know that based on what people tell you the Bible means. I'm going to tell you something that you probably haven't heard before. And whether you receive it or not will determine who has the power. If the bars that have you in prison stay, or if you can live according to liberty. Because it's a little scary living according to liberty. So, anyway, the English term Leviticus is derived from the Latin Leviticus, which in the Greek appears as Leutikon, who were what we call the Levites in English. The Greek expression seems to coincide with the rabbinic Hebrew Torat Kohanim, and I have the Hebrew word there on the page, which has to do law of priests, because its contents appears as a manual for religion, since it is concerned with the duties of the people and the priests to God and their fellow man. So there's actually a link there on the page to our article on religion. Religion at the time of the Constitution was defined as a duty. Religion was a duty. It's not what you think. It was your duty. If your duty was to obey your father and he said, put these cement bags in the back of the truck, then in order to fulfill your duty, you had to actually move the cement bags. You couldn't just sit there and I moved the cement bags in my mind. And I imagined that they got loaded in the back of the truck. No, you actually have to do it. And of course, Christ said the same thing. There's a lot of churches out there that say, you know, you don't have to do anything. But Christ said, not those who say, but those who do it. And then people make the argument, well, all you have to do is believe. Well, absolutely. All you have to do is have faith, which is a form of belief. But faith is a belief that compels actions. If, you know, and Jesus has a parable about that. Two sons, go do this. Yes, I'll go do it. He tells the other son, go do this. He says, no, I'm not going to do it. But then the next day came, and the one who said he was going to do it decided not to do it, and the one who said he wasn't going to do it decided to do it. Which one was the true son? Well, if the Jews who decided not to follow the ways of Jesus and John the Baptist and the apostles didn't do what Jesus said, then and Jesus was the Messiah, all these ifs in there, then they're not Jews. They're not Israelites anymore. They're not followers of Moses anymore. Because Moses and Jesus, according to the Testament, were in agreement. Now you can say, well, I don't believe that Moses existed. I don't believe in the transfiguration. And I don't believe that Jesus even existed. You don't have to. Right now. I mean, someday, I hope you will. But you have to choose to believe. But it isn't necessary to start the way that Jesus was talking. Because the way of Jesus was in accordance with the logos of Jesus, which is the right reason of Jesus, and the right reason of Jesus, and the right reason of Moses is going to set the captive free if you follow what they said. Well, a lot of people who read the Torah think that, okay, we have to kill a sheep, or we have to kill a red heifer, and we have to sprinkle the blood, and we have to put it on an altar and set it on fire. Because their interpretation of the words written in Leviticus tell them that that's what they should do. But that's their interpretation of the words. If all the words are going to have more than one meaning, there may be another interpretation. So then the duty is not to pile up stones, kill sheep, cut them up into pieces. We'll see that in Leviticus 1. And then set them on fire as a burnt offering. That may not be what they're telling you to do. And, the boy could look over there, see a pile of cement bags, and he's... And in front of it, there's a little sign. And the sign has on it one word, cement. And we know that that sign is saying that all the bags behind the sign are cement bags. That's the pallet with the cement bags on. But the boy looks over there and sounds out the word, if he's allowed to learn phonics. And he sees that the sign says cement. So the father says, load that cement in the pickup. And he goes over there and he looks at the bag. And he tries to lift up one. And then he looks at the sign and it says, well, he said put the cement in. So he picks up the sign and he takes it over and he puts that in the back of the pickup. And he says, I loaded the cement. The father comes and sees there's only a sign in there. All the cement bags are still back on the pallet. You didn't load the cement. You just loaded a sign that said cement. Well, this is what a lot of people have done with the Bible. It says you're supposed to get the leaven out of your bread, which actually means to get the cruelty out of your bread. Egypt had become cruel, and they taxed the people their 20% and were very strict on how they did it, and sometimes it was cruel. The way they imposed the tax on the people. Well, that's the leaven. Because leaven means oppression. So you have to establish a system of bread for the needy of your society without oppression, without force. Without forcing the contribution of 20%. The people have to do it. Jesus talked about this all the time. He had a parable on it. You know, the good master goes out and says, how much do you owe? I owe this much, 20%. How much can you pay? Well, I can't pay 20%. I can only pay 10%. And if we're following the instructions of Jesus, we'd write down paid in full. There's not many governments that do that today. Because most of the governments today are of a Babylonic nature. They're of a bondage of Egypt nature. And they were getting that way at the time of Jesus Christ, the Corban of the Pharisees. You're going to see that the word sacrifice that we're going to read over and over again, at least one word for sacrifice or offering in the Leviticus, is the word Corban. That's a sacrifice. And the first line of Leviticus 1, right away in the first paragraph there, they're telling you that they have to be free will offerings, voluntary offerings. But the Corban of the Pharisees was no longer voluntary. You signed up and you had a civil obligation to pay in to that system. Rome was doing the same. They hadn't always done that, but they started doing that. But the amount they paid in wasn't extreme for the poor, but it was extreme for some people because they were taking the wealth of other nations into their own treasury. And now Herod had another idea. But we're going to talk more about this, see if we can get through some of the outline of Leviticus so that we're better prepared when we come back to Keys of the Kingdom. Well, welcome back to Keys of the Kingdom. So, anyway, we're going to be looking at Leviticus, and I'm just preparing you because when we get into it, you're going to see that most of what you know about the Old Testament is not true because it's based on the private interpretation of people who didn't want to load the cement bags. They just wanted to put the words in place. And we have dozens of articles that take you from, you know, you're not to boil a kid in its mother's milk, and which created a huge misconception of what the Bible is about. You're not to have any leaven in your bread, which they have all kinds of leaven in their bread, but they have no yeast in the bread. You need to beware of the leaven of Herod and the Pharisees. It has nothing to do with the yeast of them. You know, that you're supposed to honor your father and your mother, and that is... It doesn't mean that you have to do everything they tell you, but you have to take care of them. Religion is taking care of the needy of your society, and pure religion is doing it unspotted by the leaven of the world, by the oppression of the world, by the forced offerings of the world. Saul was told that his kingdom would not stand. Why? Because he forced a sacrifice. He forced an offering to fund his army. And if you go down that road, it alters the nature of your own mind and therefore your own soul. Well, some people say, well, I don't believe I have a soul. Well, it's because you don't understand the meaning of the words, or maybe you're just in denial. But I'm still going to tell you the secret of how you set the captive free. So this idea of religion being a duty to who? Well, to God. God doesn't get to eat the sheep you sacrifice. He doesn't need the money you sacrifice. He's outside of space and time. He's the unmoved mover. But he knows that you need to care about others if you want others to care about you. If you need to care about the liberty and freedom and dominion of others, if you want others to care about your liberty, your freedom, your rights, if you start a system where you take away the right of others to choose, you will lose your right to choose. Without going into the Bible, just going into the, you know, philosophers through the ages. You know, as you judge, so shall ye be judged. That is in the Bible. But, you know, many scholars may generally agree that the Leviticus developed over a long period of time, reaching its present form during the Persian period between 538 and 332 BC. Okay, during the process of development, were there important changes in the text and interpretations that have altered the intent of Moses? Well, of course, that's what I'm saying. But I don't find the changes in the text itself. And we actually have Dead Sea Scrolls that we can now compare with other texts that over 2,000 years later, we have a pretty accurate view of the text. It didn't change. You know, when people were formulating the theories that the text was changing, it wasn't the text that was changing. It's our interpretation of the words. And that became more and more confusing to us, the more and more we went the way of Babylon, which is about rituals and ceremonies and robes and incense and temples and objects rather than precepts and principles. The purpose of Leviticus was to instruct the Israelites on how to maintain holiness, or what they call being sacred, which is just another way of saying being separate. How to make, because the rest of the world was going the way of Pharaoh. You know, creating a system of government where somebody's in authority and exercises that authority over others. There's a lot of people who believe in social democracy or democratic socialism. And they say they have no ruler at the top. It's the will of the people. Well, of course, they tell you that all the time, but it ends up being the will of the guys in power. Because you have, the reason you're electing somebody in power is that you think that they will fix, they will load the cement bags. You won't have to do it. You're delegating the authority to load the cement bags because it's just too hard. But of course, this weakens you. It weakens you more and more and more. And suddenly you're not separate from the bondage of Egypt. You're back in the bondage of Egypt. You're not separate from Babylon. You are in Babylon. You don't realize it because it's secret Babylon, but you're still back in Babylon. You don't think you're an idolater, but you are an idolater because you're engaging in covetous practices. And Paul tells you that covetousness is idolatry. So, but you don't know that. Your preachers didn't tell you. And you became confused about what you think the Bible is saying. And somebody wants to do a debate on, did Jesus exist? And it's not, well, you know, of course that's reasonable to ask the question. But there's all kinds of evidence, and even I know atheists and agnostics who believe that Jesus existed. Do they believe that everything they say about him is true? No, they don't. Okay. You don't have to believe it. But the Logos of Christ is basically, as you judge, so shall you be judged. If you think you have the right to take away the power of choice, take away the liberty of your neighbor, and force him into a democratic socialist government, then you will lose your right to choose as well. That's just going to happen. And if you don't load the cement bags, you're not going to get the muscles that loading the cement bags will create. So to be separate from the world of Nimrod, to be separate from the idolatry of Terah, to be separate from the bondage of Egypt, what does that look like? For Israel to do that, it says that they needed proper worship in their community and nation, ensuring that God can dwell amongst them or within them. So what is worship? So we have to look at the word worship. What does it mean? Is God creator of the universe, the divine designer, the existing one, so insecure that he needed to create millions of people to bow down and worship him? No. That's not the purpose. That isn't even the nature of worship. And of course we have an article and it's linked to on the page. We're not going to go to it right now. But worship is basically service. You're not to create these gods, these idols, and bow down and serve them. How do you serve the idols? You give them gifts. You give them 20% of your labor. That's worshiping. You serve them. You do their will. They say, you know, invade the Ukraine. They invade the Ukraine. And they have to be willing to do that even unto death. And they call that allegiance. But the Bible talks about we're supposed to have faith. Faith and allegiance are very similar. But again, like I said at the beginning, faith, true faith, epistopos, compels action. You believe it so much, you really just want to do it. When the boy figured out, oh, I have to load the cement bags, not just the sign, he knew what the task was, and he wanted to fulfill his duty to his personal giant known as his father. Because his father provided him with a shelter and with a home, and now he gave him an instruction. He wants to please his father. He didn't care if the cement bags get in, except that that would please his father. And he knew it was a struggle. And he wanted to load the cement for his father. That's worshiping his father, his natural father. It's honoring his natural father to some degree. Although the word honor can mean something quite different. But if your father in heaven says, love thy neighbor as thyself, then you wouldn't want to covet your neighbor's goods. And you wouldn't hire kings or presidents or prime ministers to take away from your neighbor so that you could have more stuff. Or you could have equal amount of stuff without working quite as hard. So that's proper worship, is that when you serve a God of righteousness, not a God of self-righteousness. And that's what Leviticus is going to tell the people how to do. How to worship God. And that is the performance of your duty to your fellow man, which is to love your fellow man. You say, well, so I have to give to charity? You have to give to charity that gives to the needy what they need. Sometimes the needy might need a good kick in the pants. And that's what you need to give them. Sometimes they need food and water. Sometimes they need shelter. But you should never boil a kid in its mother's milk. And you just go read an article on milk and meat. They use the word in the King James, seethe the kid in its mother's milk. But that actually has to do with spoiling a child. Giving him. And I said, oh no, let me help you move all those bags. Mom would go in there and try to help him move the bags. Oh, that's too much for him, honey. He can't do it. Look, he's getting tired. He's getting stronger. Stop spoiling him. Let him do it himself. That's part of worship too. Because worship is the performance of your duty to God and your fellow man. And it's your duty to your fellow man to make him stronger, not weaker. And we have lots and lots of articles on how the black community was targeted for social welfare through the state, and it destroyed the black community. They went from 3% single-parent families to 67% single-parent families. And with that, there was a rise in crime. I heard somebody talking about the fact that, that one of these white fragility people thinking that the Constitution was written for white men and to keep everybody else enslaved. And that is just such an ignorant statement that they haven't read the letters of the men who were struggling with how are we going to form a federal government, which didn't govern all the people inside the states. It was a federal government outside the states that had certain particular duties and roles to help keep the states in communion with one another. And it wasn't too bad, but people don't understand how it works. And the less they understand, the more trouble they've gotten into, because citizenship in the United States today is not the same as it was back then. And all the blacks have not been set free. They've actually been brought into servitude along with all the whites and the Chinese and the Asians and the Native Americans, the Aboriginals. They're all back in the bondage of Egypt. There's almost none of them that are free. So they have reduced, you know, a lot of people, we're going to talk about servitude, like I said, on X, Sunday nights at 5, Pacific Standard Time. But just go to Gregory at HHC or His Holy Church and follow that, and you'll get notices. We've already announced it, so you can put a pin into it to show up. But we're going to talk about servitude, how you got in it, how you get out of it, what it looks like. And how you got into it is you don't care about the rights of others as much as you care about your own rights. And you don't know where that line is actually even drawn because you don't understand where rights come from. Now, I'm talking general, not you individually. I'm just talking generalities. Generally, people don't. But proper worship of these higher ideals that come down to us through philosophers and the divine designer and the holy scriptures, where you have to love your neighbor, you can't covet his goods. If you covet his goods, your goods shall be coveted. You're obviously not supposed to steal them, and of course you probably don't steal anything you don't already covet. Although I knew when I was in the seminary, we had a kleptomaniac in the seminary. Stole everything. Rosaries, watches, prayer books. He stole it all. But he was a klepto. What we call kleptomaniac. I hate to use the word maniac, but that's a way to describe it. He had a compulsion to take stuff. He wasn't raised up in the same household I was raised up in. I won't mention his name. He may still be alive. But there was definitely trauma. Milo Yiannopoulos, who one of the most famous gays in America for quite some time until he fell out of grace. For 5 years now, he says he's not gay and he's not engaged in those practices. And he realized, and he says this, nobody is gay. Being gay is the result of trauma. That's what he has come to the conclusion of. And I actually know when he started realizing that. I was listening to him talk with somebody when he started to realize that. Still got a lot of darkness following him. He didn't grow up in the life that I grew up in. I have to deal with my own darkness. You have to deal with yours. But what Leviticus is telling us is how to deal with that. It's laying out before the people certain tasks that we call worship. And tasks we should avoid, like idolatry, to keep us out of bondage, to keep us in liberty under God, where we can load the bags of our own pickup ourselves and become stronger in the process. But if you unmoor the metaphors, you get lost and you create a religion in your mind that has nothing to do with the original intent or meaning. But it was written that way. So that you could do that. Because if they were just straight out and told you straight out without the parable, the metaphor, and the allegories of the Bible, you would have burned them all long ago. But because they are subject to misinterpretation by people with not a pure heart, they will invent false religions and get people to follow them and actually kill people who won't. Well, a great deal of what we see as Islam today is actually willing to do that. They boast it. They proclaim it. I'm not saying all of Islam, because I'm not going to group all people. But we definitely see that trend, that if you don't become like them, they're going to bomb you or kill you like the guy on the airplane. He looked like such a child when all the men held him down. I mean, they weren't hurting him, but they weren't going to let him get up. And he realized he was helpless. And then suddenly his whole demeanor changed. I could see a small child there. He's never grown up. It's not a religion that helps you grow up. It's a It's a religion that helps delude you, as I see it most oftenly practiced. The fact is I know there are people out there that were born and raised Muslims or in the Islamic religion, Shiite, Sunni, whatever denomination you want to consider, and all of a sudden they can become awake and aware of the truth and the way of the truth, or at least more of it than they are when they were devout followers. And the same with Christians. Modern Christians are very deluded, generally speaking. They're not doing what Christ said. And the Jews aren't doing what Moses said. And the Muslims aren't doing what Abraham said. And yet they consider Abraham, Moses, and Jesus prophets. But they don't see it. Because they've created their own little prison, their own little bondage of ideologies. They have gotten caught up in the rituals and ceremonies. With rituals and ceremonies that are not true to the meaning of the text. The law is spiritual. The rituals and ceremonies are pointing to that spiritual law in a way that you can grasp it and understand it. So what Leviticus is doing is setting up a sacrificial system. Well, the fact is all systems are sacrificial systems. The difference between the sacrificial system of Leviticus and the sacrificial system of Lyndon Baines Johnson or Franklin Delano Roosevelt is that sacrificial systems had to be voluntary. But FDR, you sign up, and then you had to pay it. Wasn't very much. It's like 1.5%. Now it's up to over 14% that you have to pay in one way or another. They say, well, your employer is paying part of that. Well, he's paying part of that with the money he could have paid you. But he's not going to pay you. He's going to pay part of what he would have paid you to the government. And it's going to go into the government treasuries. But the problem goes much deeper because you've created governments that could borrow money against the labor of its members. And you've become members and you have the number to prove it. And you have civil bonds that allow them to use force and require allegiance and promise you entitlements. If you have a promise of entitlement from a politician, what do you really have? Because politicians don't keep their promises. They're a peculiar people. But Israel was supposed to be a peculiar people because they operated a government with free will offerings. Now the Israel over there in the Middle East, it's a democratic socialist state. Parliamentary. They're under heavy graduated income tax. They don't have just weights and measures. They force their neighbor to contribute to their welfare. They can't have an army that can take their sons and take their daughters. And they make them run before their chariots, like it says in Samuel. Which Samuel said that if you create such a government, it will take and take and take and take and take. And their income tax is much higher than it is in the United States. But they're both operating along the same principles. But those principles aren't the principles of Abraham and Jacob. We just went through the study of Jacob. And Jacob created altars. Abraham had all these guys come to help him fight the five kings that had conquered Sodom and Gomorrah. And they dropped everything and came. Why? What did they have in common? They built altars. Those altars were free will altars also. And this is the distinction that made the Israelites a peculiar people. Now there's a lot of people who might call themselves Israelites or Israelis or whatever, but are they doing what the Bible says? Well, they'll tell you they are, but that's based on their interpretation. The interpretation we're looking at is going to be different. And I'm not picking on Israelis or Jews or anybody. Because the Christians are doing the same thing that they're doing. As a matter of fact, one of the greatest supporters of the country of Israel over there is Christians. And we just heard on the news before this particular program started that in Africa that and other places that people are being attacked and tried as traitors because they say they're Christians and therefore they assume that they're aligned with nations like the United States, which is considered their enemies. It's because everybody's choosing up sides. There's only two sides in the world today that you should even consider. And they're not based on charismatic people or personalities or books or anything. It's righteousness and unrighteousness. And unrighteousness is not really even a side. Unrighteousness is simply the absence of righteousness. So the system we see set up in Leviticus is to help lead you towards righteousness. And they talk about atonement. We'll have to talk about atonement too. But what is that? Is it the same thing? I mean, you don't find the word charity anywhere in the Old Testament or in Leviticus, but you see voluntary offerings. That's charity. And it's only that system that operates on voluntary offerings, free will offerings, they do say that too, or what we see in the New Testament is charity. It's only that charity that can create the social bonds of faith, hope, and charity, which is a different form of allegiance. It's an allegiance to what is right and just and fair. This is why we're told to seek the kingdom of God and His righteousness. And the Logos of Christ, He's explaining what that righteousness looks like. We'll be right back to Keys of the Kingdom. So, welcome back. So, we're looking at the sacrificial system, the idea of a sacrificial system. All governments have sacrificial systems. There's just the governments that allow you to make the sacrifice by individual and personal choice, and the governments that force those sacrifices on you, either by the rule of a president, prime minister, king, or emperor, or the one that is elected by representatives of the people and for the people and by the people, but not the people themselves. The kingdom of God, and this is what we'll see, is actually a network of people who gather together without the intent to force anybody to do anything, but they choose to walk with one another under a moral guideline of what is righteous. But then they have to have that righteousness eventually written on their hearts and upon their minds, so that as a matter of faith, they are compelled to be righteous with one another. Unfortunately, ego and vanity allows us to create these private interpretations of the Torah that create all kinds of rituals and ceremonies where it's easier to give somebody a little wafer of bread, or blow a little incense towards them, or bathe them in a rabbinical or Christian baptism, and then they're saved. But if any of those religions are also saying, go to the fathers of the earth, the men who exercise authority, the Abimelechs and Nimrods and pharaohs and federal governments of the world, to obtain benefits at the expense of your neighbor through men who exercise authority one over the other, they're not following Christ, they're not following the prophets, they're not following Moses, they're not following the ways of Abraham and Jacob. And they are not. And if you're not following the ways of Jacob, you're not Israel. But that's just, and I only tell you that not to belittle anybody or put anybody down or divide people more, but to get individuals. Because I can't force individuals, much less can individuals gather together in a collective and force other people in the world or in their country to go their way. And the reality in most countries, you don't have to. The practice of religion is the pure religion is to do this, to take care of one another without depending upon the men who exercise authority. whether they are the fathers of the earth, the Abimelechs of the earth, the Nimrods of the world, and the pharaohs of the world, and the federal governments of the world. Because if you go to those men who exercise authority one over the other, you will degenerate. You will weaken as an individual, as a family, as a community, and as a society, and as a nation. And we'll show you this over and over again. We have shown people over and over again that this is the case, and it's right reason to believe it. And you don't need the Bible to show this or prove this, which is why we quote all kinds of Greek philosophers, and I even quote plumbers. And presidents and prime ministers, all the important people in the world. But then there's the priests and the role of the priests in these systems of social welfare, social safety nets, these tables of welfare. You know, David says there is a table that should have been for your welfare, but is actually a snare and a trap. And if you set the table of your welfare system in whatever government or whatever country you're in, if you set that table with benefits based on forcing contributions of your neighbor, then that system will become a snare and a trap, because the same force that you apply to your neighbor to get them to contribute to your social democracy or democratic socialist state, to provide guaranteed wages or whatever you want to do, that same force is going to be applied to you. And if you think that you can control that power, once you let that open up that Pandora's box and say that it is okay to covet your neighbor's goods through, as long as you do it through the administration of governments that you create for yourself, you have every right to do that. When the people wanted a king with Samuel, they said, give us a king. He says, oh my gosh. And so Samuel consulted with God somehow. Of course, we saw Jacob walking with God. We saw Moses walking with God. We see other men walking with God. And they just seem to have this divine revelation to come up with their conclusions. And the conclusion was that if you've force your neighbor to contribute to your welfare, you will go under the same power of force. And whoever controls that power controls you. And we don't call it living by faith. We call it living by allegiance. Because this is a choice that lays out before you. You live by faith, hope, and charity, or you descend into bondage where you have to live by force, fear, and fealty. People don't give out of love, they give out of fear. What's that going to breed in your society? More fear. You'll become so afraid that suddenly somebody will say, there's a disease that might kill you. You can't see it, smell it, taste it, or touch it. We have a test that you don't understand, and it will tell you whether you have it. And the only salvation is that we inject something into your blood, into your muscle tissues, an intramuscular injection. The only thing that will save you. And you're so afraid you believe it, even though you can hear in their voice that what they're saying is not true. At least I could. But people wouldn't believe me, so I went and looked it up. And I, in order to know where to look, I had to ask God, is there somebody that knows that you can't do this safely? I found Suzuki, Key, doctor after doctor who was doing studies saying, no, this is a bad thing. And I published it on a page at Preparing You, and we let people know in our network. We let people know in our county. We have the least vaccinated county in the state of Oregon, probably on the West Coast. And although I've seen lots of people die of plugged arteries, turbo cancers, two. Usually the people who get turbo cancers, they get two forms of turbo cancer. at the same time. Just one person after another. Amazing. Kind of depends on what batch you got, because there was no way that they were going to gear up that fast and do a good job. Nobody was allowed to. I mean, your beef is better inspected than your injection. But anyway, let's get back to the priests. Leviticus details the responsibilities and qualifications of the public servants of that government. And they called those public servants priests of a nation. And that nation was supposed to be a nation of, for, and by the people. But that peculiar people that wanted to seek the righteousness of the God of creation, whatever that is. And we have lots of places that, we've already talked about where part of that righteousness of the God of creation is that you're not to take away the rights of your neighbor. You're supposed to make it so your neighbor doesn't have the right to choose. You should, if you want the right to choose, you have to allow your neighbor the right to choose. And the people who say, well, let's tax the rich, well, evidently they don't want to let the rich decide what to give and what not to give. And they can facetiously say, well, if we let them decide, they won't give anything. Well, in many cases, that's true, because you've lost the motivating factor for the rich to give that should be built into your system. But you've lost that because you've already gone away from some of the other things they talk about in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, that your system of justice doesn't understand justice. It doesn't understand how to have a system of justice. And we just had a judge in Minnesota in the court they were in. It's an administrative court. And the jury found the person, based on the facts, that they were guilty of, corruption, stealing money from the government coffers. And they found them guilty. And the judge threw out their verdict because she didn't even let them judge the facts. Already in that court, she was allowed to judge the law. And I think she did a poor job on appeals that she'll probably be overturned. She looks like a little kid. I don't think she understands the law at all, which is common. I mean, I can show you guys writing about the law schools in the 1930s were being graduated with no understanding of the Constitution. And it's only gotten worse. Because they don't understand morality or anything. But the reality is that you don't understand the courts that they're also going to set up are based on the same system of social welfare through charity alone, through free will offerings alone, because that's what the altars were, and we're going to see that as we go through chapters 1 all the way up into chapter 16. And you can do extra work by going to our article on sophistry and reading that, and finding out how we were so deceived. Because where was their system of social welfare? I recently asked two different AI models or programs, what was the system of social welfare in the Old Testament? I also asked in the New Testament, but. I got a really good first paragraph answer from Gemini. Not so good from Grok, but maybe Grok will give a better answer now if I go back there and ask the same question. I've recorded all this so I could do it. But I had to argue with Grok, and eventually it conceded that the altars were systems of social welfare. And because I kept just throwing quotes at him, I said, well, then what do you do with this? And I probably wouldn't get full access to Grok, but however it works, it's just software. But if a machine can figure it out, you can figure it out. And it was helpful so that I could write these articles with all the extra footnotes that you need. There's probably several hundred links on our first page of Leviticus, and there'll be thousands before you get done, so that you can start tying all these things together. What's the Sanhedrin? What was the little flock that Jesus talked about? What did he mean in Matthew 21:43? Therefore say I unto you, the kingdom of God shall be taken from you and given to a nation, bringing forth the fruits thereof. And how do you bring forth those? You cannot bring forth the fruits of righteousness with an unrighteous system full of leaven. And I'm using those metaphor, leaven. Leaven is, again, oppression. So there had to be some sort of community guidelines. But again, the priests are just the public servants. They're a vast bureaucracy, a network of people that are providing social welfare through that network and are also tied to the social justice system and the appeals courts of Israel, and therefore to the police of Israel, which was every person. So the rich man's got a lot of wealth. He wants his wealth protected. He can go to your corporate governments and look for protection. But if he does wrong to the local people and turns the local people against him, he has no protection because it's the people's courts. The courts are built from the bottom up the same way the social safety net is built from the bottom up. You don't have to give anything to any Levite. That's a weakness of the system, but it is also the strength. Paul says, my weakness is my strength. And the boy loading the cement bags saw very acutely his weakness, his skinny arms, his skinny legs, the sweat pouring off him. The bags just seemed to get heavier and heavier, but he kept at it till it was done. And he became stronger in the practice. But you don't practice charity anymore. You barely, if you're a Democrat, you probably have less charity than your counter-Republican partner. Republicans give far more charity than the Democrats. But the Democrats voted you your benefits at the expense of your neighbor. The Republican does that too, but not as much. Both Democrat and Republican in the United States, left and right in the United States, has moved more and more in one direction. And the kingdom of God is not on either side of left and right. The kingdom of God is seeking righteousness. What is righteousness? And if you want, the greatest destroyers of liberty are the givers of gifts, gratuities, and benefits. That's Plutarch, a pagan. Didn't use the Bible. That's where your rights and freedoms are going. You say, well, we want this right back and we want that right back. When are you going to take your responsibilities back? You don't care about your neighbor. You don't care about your neighbor's rights. You don't care about your neighbor's freedom or his liberty or his right to choose. You care about the benefits you get by giving the power to men who exercise authority. And Samuel, go back to Samuel 8, probably verse 10. You read the whole thing. That when you choose this president, prime minister, emperor, king, whatever you want to call him, who's going to exercise authority, he's going to be the chief executive officer of your civil government, the government you've created for yourself. He's going to take and take and take and take and take and take. He's going to even take your sons and daughters. And when you cry out, God's not going to hear you because you didn't hear your neighbor. You see, God is going to hear you, but he's not going to respond to you because you didn't respond to your neighbor. What is, if over the last 80 years in the United States, I've seen it, where people have become more and more that way. They hear people screaming in the streets and they pull their shades. They hear people are in need, they don't come to their aid. The hue and cry has been isolated out of the community. They don't come to each other's aid. And so what do you do to create a system where people go back to that hue and cry, where they care about their neighbor and they learn to care? That's a process. It requires priests who do not exercise authority won over, like the vast bureaucracy. We have an article on vast bureaucracy. But it's because it's a vast bureaucracy that does not exercise authority. If the priest isn't doing his job, you don't give to him. If the Levite doesn't do his job, you don't give to him. And there are other restrictions on them, which we'll talk about later, but we're running out of time. So the community guidelines that are laid out, this book provides statutory guidelines regarding the pursuit of nurturing a community practices, restrictions concerning the parasitic indulgences, and the moral conduct of both laity and priests. And the priests are a separate class, but they have no power until you give it to them on an individual basis. This is what's so important. How do you have a national government without taking away individual rights? This is what the book is about, from the beginning to the end, is how you have a government of the people, for the people, and by the people, which is why that phrase used by Lincoln was first seen, as far as I can tell, in the original translation of the Bible back there with Wycliffe in the foreword. This is the book for the government of the people, for the people, and by the people. It was telling you, your social safety net, which government provides, that government provides, that government called the church, or the church in the wilderness, provides for the people through charity alone, weakens the government that exercises authority. It limits government back to protecting the borders and a few other things that were granted it by the Constitution. I know all kinds of people are trying to force the U.S. government to go back, and they say they're violating, they're usurping power. No. Through the contract clause, you applied to it and said, you take care of me. You provide my daily ministration. I'm not going to worry about the poor. You worry about the poor. But I'm going to give you the power to tax my labor. And you give me a number to prove that I'm a part of your system. That's what the Pharisees were doing and Herod was doing with the system of Corbin. And it makes the word of God to none effect. It makes the logos of God, the right reason of God, to none effect. Because you have already judged that it's okay to take away from your neighbor to get what you want. That is not going to create the social bonds of a free community. It's going to create bonds, but they're going to be civil bonds and civil authorities. And then they're going to create administrative courts, mostly in 1910 and 1911. They've been around since the Judiciary Act of 1789, which we go through. I know a lot of these things are not going to, people aren't going to know what I'm talking about. But you haven't worked at seeking the kingdom of God or his righteousness for decades. You have churches that tickle your ears and tell you that you're already saved. You don't have to do what Jesus actually said. You don't even have to try. You don't even have to try to find out what he said. And through sophistry, they have fooled you because they tell you that this is what this word means and this is what that word means. Moses called out men, called the Levites, to be the church in the wilderness. And they had a particular status. But they had no power. They had no funds. Yeah, you were to tithe to them, but your choice. Says there over and over again, tithe to them according to their service, no tithing. What government does that? Only free governments do that. And you don't have to overthrow the government that exists. You just have to repent and seek the government of righteousness. The government that sets, you want to be set free? Start setting your neighbor free. Start taking back your responsibility to care about your neighbor in whatever means and way that you think is right. If you're not thinking right, it's going to have an effect. But if you are thinking right, that's going to have an effect. But if you won't set the neighbor free, you're not going to be free. You're going to be degenerating on a regular basis. Jesus had a little flock, which was like the Levites, and he appointed unto them a kingdom. They had certain requirements. We'll get into that later. Certain criteria. Jesus, very specific, said it over and over again. But you don't know where that is. But we'll eventually tell you. But Leviticus can be the foundation for understanding the relationship between God and man and men and men, emphasizing the importance of worship, not pomp, not posturing, worship in the sense of service. And of course, like I said, God doesn't need your help, but religion was defined as the pious performance of a duty to God and your fellow man. Your fellow man might need your help to protect his rights, to protect his family if something happens to him, to give him a hand up now and then. But that's going to be up to you. You have to start caring about the rights of others before others will care about your rights. Some are already caring about them and have spent a lifetime trying to explain what the Bible is really trying to tell you. And we could go, you know, I've mentioned the Art of Vedas and a lot of other books are trying to tell you the same things. But you have to seek it. You have to find, this is the way of Christ, is the way of Moses, the way of Jacob, therefore the way of true Israel. Is that the way you want to go, or you want to go another way? Well, that's what we're going to be talking about. Join us on X. Join us at Preparing You. Join the network in your area. Get more and more updates. Get helping. Get our help. Till then, peace on your house. And may God be with you. God bless.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.